Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I am Vladislav Lilic, a doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University. In today's episode, it will be my pleasure to host Rebecca Bryant, professor of cultural anthropology at Utrecht University, and Mette Hatay, the senior research consultant at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. We will be discussing their splendid co-authored book, Sovereignty Suspended, Building the So-Called State, published by University of Pennsylvania Press in 2020. Sovereignty Suspended is based on more than two decades of ethnographic and archival research in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, an entity that looks like a state and acts like a state, but that much of the world says does not or should not exist. The monograph traces the process by which the north portion of the Mediterranean island of Cyprus began to emerge as a separate but unrecognized state-like space following the violent partition of the mid-1970s. The authors excavate the contradictions and paradoxes of life in a de facto state, arguing that it is only by rethinking the concept of de facto statehood as a realm of social and cultural practice that we will come to understand the longevity of such states and what it means to live in them. Dr. Bryant, Mr. Hatay, welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me about your work.
Thank you for having us.
Hi.
As is customary on our channel, I will start us off by asking about the genesis of Sovereignty Suspended. How did your separate intellectual trajectories lead you to the writing of the book, and how did the process of co-authorship operate in this case?
Shall I start?
Sure, go ahead.
All started around 10 years ago, yeah, with the curiosity regarding these meta-narratives existing around the Cyprus problem, yeah. But in these meta-narratives, Turkish Cypriots or this entity in the north usually is like a made-up a kind of entity with no actorship of Turkish Cypriots. So it was like imposed by Turkey, according to some, or it was created by Turkey, according to some, or it was, nationalistic way of founding a state. Yeah. So, we said there is something else. So in this, Turkish Cypriots, we believe that they are somehow. Because my computer, I think it's going beep, 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 and Rebecca is panicking.
Because it's going beep, beep, beep.
Yeah.
Okay, now.
We believe that, we felt that the Turkish Cypriots were partners in this crime as well. We started going back to archives, interviewing people, try to see their agency in this endeavor, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think, though, that maybe maybe your question is really trying to get at something a little bit different. I mean, this is sort of the intellectual genesis of the project, but thinking about more the intellectual trajectory and what led us here, mm-hmm. I actually began research in the island in the early 1990s, mm-hmm. you know, as an anthropologist, and at the time was more interested in the competing nationalisms on the island, which, you know, at that moment was a very hot topic. Nationalism studies was very big at that moment. And so I, you know, came to the island, spent almost 3 years here, and did at that time spend quite a lot of time in the north. And you know, one of the most striking things in the island, at particularly maybe at that moment, because at that time the checkpoints dividing the island were closed. The most striking thing was really the differences that one felt, experienced going between the two sides of the island, and the, you know, the perceptual differences that one experienced when going into this unrecognized state, and how so much of that non-recognition was so very present in everyday life. And I think that at that time, I didn't really have the right questions to ask about that. And it took me quite a long time to begin to get at those questions. And Mette and I happened to meet and start working together at a moment when I think I was getting more ready to think about those questions. And at that moment, I was really interested in the relationship between governmentality and sovereignty. So I framed it more in terms of, in sort of Foucauldian terms, you know, in terms of the governmentality of the North, how a state that is not recognized still exercises control. And you know, Mette was at that time had a long history of activism in the North as well, and he was I met him actually first as more of an activist as an activist researcher, I suppose, but I knew of him first as an activist in various peace organizations, and also at the time that I was doing research, he was very active in explaining a particular United Nations plan that was on the table to the people. So he was on TV a lot and doing all that kind of explanation. So anyway, we met. We began to discuss these various paradoxes about life in an unrecognized state, and that's really how the project began.
Thank you for a lovely introduction. I mean, it is safe to assume that most listeners would only have a general idea of the island's recent past. Would you care to offer a brief historical overview of the events leading to the establishment of the de facto state of Northern Cyprus?
I try to be brief because I usually lose myself in details. That's the main clashes we have now and again. Cyprus had its own post-colonial period, which ended up as a Republic of Cyprus, founded by, interestingly, not its own people, by three guarantor states, Turkey, Greece, and United Kingdom, as a compromise. So those nationalists within the island, Turkish and Greek nationalists, who were aspiring for different goals, Greek Cypriots were aspiring to be united with Greece, and Turkish Cypriots were aspiring to have a division in the island and have a double enosis, as they called it. North will be part of Turkey, south will be part of Greece. That ended up as Republic of Cyprus, as a compromise based on concessional system, functional federalism, you could call it, without territories, yeah? Because then both communities were spread around the island. They didn't have places where the, you know, Turkish Cypriots were in majority or something like this. But Turkish Cypriots were numerically the minority, around 20% of the island, but they were dispersed around the island. So in their imagination of having a Taksim, the division, they need the space. And in knowing this, the Greek Cypriots were also opposing any kind of positive discrimination handed over to the Turkish Cypriots in order to run the Republic of Cyprus as a concessional partners. So in 63, the republics lasted only 3 years. Again, the communities went back to their initial goals. And the Republic of Cyprus was taken over by the Greek Cypriot majority. Turkish Cypriot sort of locked themselves up in military enclaves. Mm-hmm. And of course, that isolation or this ghetto period went on for until 68. Until 60, there was a siege around Turkish Cypriots in different ghettos. And there they established their proto-state in that sense. We had another articles and work on describing that more explicitly, how they in a way prepared the administration, the governmentality of the entity in the enclaves, managing themselves somehow, yeah? And so it was an experiment for them, for the entity that they were going to find found after 74 division, which was the result of the coup d'etat of the Greek Cypriots who were not happy with Makarios, who and backed by the junta in Greece, they wanted to oust Makarios from the power. And Turkey used this as a pretext and came and divided the island. Yeah, so we have the Republic of Cyprus functioning as a Greek Cypriot state in reality, de facto Greek Cypriot state. And in north, after the population exchanges during the war and after the war, you have the ethnic Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which was established as first as a federated state of Turkish Cypriots, and in 83, after the failure of the negotiations, they proclaimed it as a separate state, and so forth. So, but what we tried to, that's the summary of the history, so we can go to other.
Well, I would just say that one thing Mete didn't mention is that when we were writing the book, I mean, this could be interesting to you or to the listeners, when we first began writing this book, one of the things that we were really focusing on was actually this enclave period, because you know, it was really a kind of rehearsal for statehood, and it was very interesting the ways that Turkish Cypriots established this state within a state in dispersed enclaves throughout the island. And we started writing initially about that also because Mete was a child during that period. And so when we first started writing, we also included quite a bit of memoir in it. And we ended up having to sort of cut some of that when we shifted the focus more to the post-74 period. But yeah, I mean, we were also looking at these different formations, these different moments of political where Turkish Cypriots attempted to realize some kind of political agency, mm-hmm. and how that began first in the 1950s in a kind of proto-state based on organizations, and then in the 1960s, this state within a state, and then this de facto entity after 74.
And the concept of operatic state drives much of your analysis. You argue that Northern Cyprus has been caught in an aporia, a tension between its well-defined attributes of statehood and the uncertainty of its international status. Could you perhaps elaborate on the concept of aporatic state and explain how you have mobilized it to dissect the ambiguities of de facto statehood?
Yeah, you know, unrecognized states are often referred to as states in waiting. And that of course, suggests that they are entities that are there, right? They occupy a space they are places, but they are, they're waiting for something. They're waiting to become space. They're waiting to acquire statehood, right? When we began to focus much more on this issue of what it's like to live with these de facto entities, we saw that this idea of waiting, of being in a kind of limbo, was really pervasive in everyday life. And it created a lot of uncertainty for people. So in fact, that's belirsizlik, you know, uncertainty is the word that you hear on people's lips all the time. And people are always, you know, waiting for normalization. They want their lives to be normalized because they see that this limbo that they're in is not normal, because, you know, there's a kind of division between waiting for a solution and being in a kind of, well, what's usually called a frozen conflict, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, a life going on. So time itself seems to be divided into these two different sort of layers, where on the one hand you have the lack of recognition that creates this state in waiting, and on the other hand, everyday life continuing. And so that kind of contradiction is what we were really trying to pry apart. And we thought about it in many different ways. And particularly, we began thinking about liminality. Mm-hmm. But liminality didn't quite get at this contradictory effect, because liminality seemed to suggest that they were just suspended, right? I mean, that's obviously the title, Sovereignty Suspended, right? But not everything is suspended, because what we're saying in the book is that you have this contradiction, you have this division between, on the one hand, sovereignty being suspended, but on the other hand, life going on.
Can I add something here? The people tend to mix the anxieties in the North regarding the suspension, and also there are a hell of a lot of status anxieties at the same time. So what they gain during this period, they're frightened that in the future they might lose it. So there's this constant worry of becoming something, but also the fear of losing something, possibility of losing something. So these are the contradictions constantly shaping the everyday life.
But if we come to the issue of the aporetic state, that concept is really intended to get to precisely this kind of division that I was describing between, on the one hand, a sense of everything being suspended and being in waiting, and on the other hand, life going on. Because we take that idea of the aporia actually from Derrida's understanding of it, where he describes the aporia as something that is impossible and yet should be possible, right? He talks about it as the sort of border that you should be able to cross and that you can't. And So we wanted to look at what happens when you have something that on the one hand, as we describe it there, is real. It's real because it's real in the sense that other people recognize it as real. Yeah. I mean, that we focus on the term de facto quite a bit, because the de facto contains a lot of that paradox. In other words, the very fact of calling something de facto, on the one hand, says that you recognize it as something that's real, it's a fact, right? But on the other hand, you're denying that fact. So it contains that paradox within it. And So what we're focusing on is precisely that you know, that there is something that other people see as real, and yet that thing is not realizable. Yeah. So we're focusing on the one hand what people identify as being real. In other words, when you look at a de facto state, you see something that's real. People see something that's real. And, you know, in the literature to date, or prior to our book, I guess, the focus had been on basically kind of trying to list all the things that make a de facto state a state, right? So people in the literature, there's a small, you know, literature on unrecognized states. And in that literature, there's usually an attempt to sort of list the qualities that would make these states. Yeah. So it could be things like controlling territory and things of that sort. But those definitions are often problematic, because then it requires every single state to sort of fit the definition. And what we focused on instead was the fact that we already know this, right? We can already point to these things and say, okay, that's a de facto state. So what we really wanted to get at was what we recognize there. But then how it is that on the one hand, these things are acknowledged, but on the other hand, they're not internationally recognized, and how that paradox plays itself out in everyday life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's a wonderful segue into my next question, or a pair of questions. In part one, you show how Turkish Cypriots constructed the north as a separate space, and how a de facto territory emerged as a perceptible entity, something that can be seen, experienced, despite all efforts to deny its existence. Could you say a few more words about the social practices of delineating the physical space of de facto statehood, erecting borders, inscribing the community into the landscape, replanting physical bodies? And in addition, would you describe how the international order's hegemonic realism, as you call it, has worked to alter North Cyprus invisible?
Okay. Yeah, I'll just say one or two things, and then I'm going to let Mete give a few examples here. But yeah, we divide the book into three parts, right? I won't go into, you know, everything that's in all these parts, but I think it's important to sort of acknowledge these three parts, because they're all about different forms of this aporia. So the first part that you're talking about talks about this aporia of perceptibility, where the very practices that Turkish Cypriots tried to engage in after 1974 to make themselves more visible ended up making them invisible. Yeah. And that is very interesting, because what we're saying basically there is that on the one hand, Turkish Cypriots created this perceptible entity through practices of controlling territory and creating borders and
becoming more Turkish.
Yes, symbolically and so on. And on the other hand, as they were doing that, they were trying to make they were using symbols of Turkishness. And so in the process of using those symbols, they actually created even more the perception that it was not they who were doing this, but rather it was Turkey. So maybe you want to give some examples.
Yeah, I mean, the minor differences that you play on in order to show the differences between communities. Yeah. So the Cypriots, yeah, the language is the obvious one. So, but the reflection of the languages was on the landscape as well, changing the signposts, the alphabet, you know, the Greek alphabet disappeared from North Cyprus. For example, most of the village mosques didn't have minarets, but immediately there were a lot of minarets appearing, especially in the border areas where the Greek Cypriots can see. A huge flag everywhere. There's one which is the biggest flag, they say, carved on the landscape on the mountain with charcoal. So slogans and everything. Of course, while they were becoming more Turkish in order to become less Greek or less influenced by Greek, they were never Greek, but I mean, to cleanse the influences of the Greek culture on them, they become more Turkish. But when they become more Turkish, they became irrelevant because they were like part of 80 million now, in a sense that they needed difference against Turkey somehow to sustain their separateness. So the actual guess for self-determination against Greek Cyprus turned a guess for independence against Turkey in that sense, to demand respect from Turkey for their cultural differences. There were minor differences with the Greek Cypriot, but even with Turkey, it was even more minor. So there was this collective narcissism born out of that with these narratives, with these differences. So it reflected itself in everyday life and in the politics. Now you have a lot of tension with Turkey. A lot of parties, the federation became even more need for some people to save their cultural identity in that sense.
Turkish Cypriots became invisible within this larger Turkish national corpus, the corpus of 80 million, as you put it. But what is the work that the international community or the so-called international community did to alter North Cyprus invisible through what you see as hegemonic realism?
Right. So, the argument about hegemonic realism, of course, goes throughout the book. But that's the idea that that we take partly from James Scott. That we can understand hegemony by the way that it creates what is. But that it separates the possible from the impossible, or the realistic from the unrealistic, we're using hegemonic realism to describe the way that certain futures were always seen as unrealistic. How, for example, the idea of having a separate state was for a large part of the community always seen as an unrealistic option, because it was not one that was permitted by the international community. So what was permitted was federation, we quote quite a lot of politicians in the book talking about federation as the realistic option, right? That anything else is not realistic. But that realism is this kind of hegemonic realism. In other words, it's the international community that's defining that as realistic, right? So so that argument is, it continues throughout the book, because that is really ultimately, you know, how this aporia is defined, how it is shaped.
I mean, the latest example is the current government is the nationalist government who believes that they're gonna get the Republic of TRNC recognized. Mm-hmm. So this new president keeps voicing demand for recognition and how it is possible to get the state recognized. So the former president 2 days ago said to him, "What you're saying is actually putting you in more trouble to be perceptible, because that's not possible, and you are running away from the politically correct version of the Cyprus problem in that sense. So actually saying that tactically we have to say we want federation in order to become more Turkish Cypriot or acknowledge as Turkish Cypriot.
In order to be visible.
Visible. So all these paradoxes continuously plays out.
Yeah, so in the case of this invisibilization, it's this hegemonic realism that defines what is perceptible, right? Yes. That defines certain persons, entities, ideologies as being acceptable and therefore perceptible, and others as not. So federation is, because it's the acceptable and realistic solution, right? It means that those who espouse it can have interactions with the international community, right? The international community acknowledges them and so on. But anything else is considered to be, not perceptible, but in a particular way as well. So actually, we talk a little bit about what I have another book that I'm writing at the moment, and where I talk about this a bit more. But in this book, we talk a little bit about what we call the puppet pirate dilemma, mm-hmm. right? In other words, that Turkish Cypriots, for the most part, have been cast and represented either as puppets of Turkey, right, and therefore without any kind of will, or pirates, a pirate state, right, which is also outside the international community, you know, kind of pariah. And in either case, because they're not sort of within the fold of the international community, right, they are not really visible. And in neither case do they have, well, in one case, in the case of puppets, they have no will. And in the case of pirates, they seem to have too much will.
I particularly enjoyed the argument you present in part two, where you address the manners in which, among other things, the Turkish Cypriot community enacted a state for itself. So how did the ordinary citizens' expectations from their de facto state shape its nature in the early years of state building?
Yeah, I mean, so this is very interesting, because what we're describing there, this is where we get into the sort of aporia of recognition, as we call it, aporia of recognizability, pardon, where we're talking about the ability to be recognized as a state, not recognized necessarily in terms of the international order, but to be recognizable as such. Mm-hmm. And there we're talking about the very things that would make them recognizable, mm-hmm. as states also made them unrecognizable in the sense of the international order. So, mm-hmm. For example, this is something that state builders at the time were really aware of. And when I say state builders, I mean that collection of
elites,
political parties and so on that were instrumental in building this state. And they were constantly balancing what they were building on the ground against what they anticipated the international order would allow them to do, right? So this was always in the forefront of their minds, and so it's what we're doing there is describing how, for example, they would debate in the parliament, you know, the things like whether or not they could expropriate certain properties. And what, in this case, expropriation would mean, and where, for instance, certain factories were being expropriated and turned into a kind of collective enterprise, state-run enterprise that employed a lot of people. But then there was at one point there was a debate in the parliament, a representative from the main leftist party. Was protesting that they were considering selling certain of these properties, and he was talking about them as state resources and so on, or common resources. I can't remember the exact term that was used. And, you know, a businessman who was also in the parliament came back and said, well, you know, you act as though these have always been ours, but in fact, you know, it was just circumstance that the Turkish army went through one place and not the other, and now these factories ended up in our hands, right? So there was this interesting awareness of the contingency of what they had in their hands, but also of the fact that ultimately it could change, because they were also trying to buffer themselves against potential legal challenges. And trying to figure out how they could maneuver around those potential legal challenges and so on.
The last part of the book is based on extensive ethnographic research, mainly from the 1990s, and it deals with the aporia of agency. There you ask how North Cypriot citizens have lived with, contested, and manipulated their own so-called state, right? How has this dynamic relationship between victimhood, helplessness, this uncertainty and desire for agency, be that individual or communal, informed the book's understanding of sovereignty?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to say one thing again, and then I'll give a couple of examples.
No, go ahead.
But, you know, when we were doing the research for this book, one of the things that we really struggled to explain was precisely what we ultimately get to in the end, which is the ways that Turkish Cypriots in everyday life use a certain kind of helplessness and victimhood. Mm-hmm. And of course we wanted to be able to explain that in a way that would be, you know, faithful to the people that we interact with and so on. So this is one reason that we gave this long historical introduction to it. But essentially what we're getting to there again goes back to this issue of hegemonic realism. And the ways that perceptibility on the part of the international community is so tied to representing oneself in particular ways, and so there are ways in which one can sort of portray oneself as a victim in order to accomplish certain things within such a system. Mete, maybe you want to give an example of this.
No, I mean, victimhood has an economy. Yeah. So, and as I tried to explain earlier on, now we have two perpetrators, Greek Cypriots and Turkey as well. So depending on the situation, if it's Turkey demanding something from Turkish Cypriots, and because Turkey, when they do financial aid, send financial aid to Turkish Cypriots, now it's increasingly more and more they attach to austerity measures in order to transform North into more neoliberal state. So of course Turkish Cypriots resist that, but they cannot openly resist it, but they employ different tactics. So immediately they play the victim. The government's changes, they do a lot of they do a lot of exaggerations and things like that, as Scott nicely talks about these hidden scripts, when a lot of pretendants go. Same thing with the relations with the Greek Cypriot side. Of course, it's not just Turkish Cypriots, but the Greek Cypriots also use these tactics as well. But Turkish Cypriots, of course, the not being able to draft a strategy, because as we say, they are on everything is suspended, or they are on limbo. Most of the time, it's saving the day kind of tactics they employ in their survival with their survival instincts. So that becomes quite a performative show if you sit and start watching their tactics. And we try to sort of give some examples in the book. Actually, Rebecca's coming book has more ethnographic work on this kind of performances. Rebecca.
Yeah. I mean, so by apory of agency, what we're really trying to get at is how, you know, how you become a political agent or become agentive, mm-hmm. only to the extent that you're actually kind of handcuffed, right? Yeah. And so, but also we're trying to get at what Mete was kind of suggesting, which is this idea of being kind of sandwiched between between two powers, between the Republic of Cyprus on the one hand and the Republic of Turkey on the other, and how within that context it's often a matter of finding the right tactics to use to acquire a certain limited agency or constrained agency in relationship to your attempts to pass through one door or the other.
This is a wonderful point, if I may. This basically leads us back to the question of sovereignty, and you disaggregate it from the territorial nation state, allowing the reader to see sovereignty as this constrained capacity, as a capacity of getting by within the international order. Could you make that link between your analysis and the concept of sovereignty as such?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing that we, again, you know, struggled with as we were writing this, struggled to really articulate, and it only kind of came out at the end, and then we had to go back and do some revisions to make it fit in. But this idea that really we articulate most clearly, I guess, in the introduction and the conclusion, but I think is clear throughout. This idea of sovereign agency. In other words, that ultimately, looking at what Turkish Cypriots have struggled for and wanted historically, it has not been a territorial state, not per se. There have been at different points nationalist leaders and nationalist parties who say, oh, you know, we have to get recognition for the TRNC. But again, this is really quite contingent. I mean, it's really because they're stuck, right? And they need something to happen. And federation isn't happening. And nothing is happening. So, they've got this entity, so let's get it recognized. You know, that's really what's pushing them more than anything else. But if you look at it historically, what Turkish Cypriots have worked for is actually a political equality and self-determination, and they haven't really been so concerned about the form that it takes, right? So this is why we talk about sovereign agency as something that is, of course, perhaps not even realizable, right? it's something that, but it's a way of having political voice and political legibility. In other words, being able to realize one's communal desires, yeah. And of course, this may be, you know, more aspiration than something that's realizable. But it is, we are arguing, much more the driving force here than some desire for territorial sovereignty.
I mean,
which also, yeah, Mr. Hatay, please.
Yeah, I mean, it has layers. We call it the double minority impasse as well, in a sense, the existing situation in Cypriots, like the Turkish Cypriots are frightened of the majority Greek Cypriots, and the Greek Cypriots are frightened of the Turkey. So, and there's this interlinks between these layers. Turkish Cypriots are right in the it's underneath, but they can collaborate with the one on the top very easily. So all these maneuvers are the politics in the everyday life. If Turkey intervenes too much, then Turkish Cypriots become the victims of Turkey, and they try to sort of get help from Republic of Cyprus or from international community, in a sense. So all these dual identities and dual positioning is constantly the way to survive.
This sort of constrained agency.
Yeah, constrained agency. Yeah.
And here, statehood basically appears as a tool and not a goal in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the because it was not historically what Turkish Cypriots were after, not per se, but somehow they got stuck with it, because this is what's available, right? We don't have many non-state forms in which people can realize some kind of political or sovereign agency, so it means that they've been constrained to this state form as well.
But also create them a kind of conformity. So now they don't make concessions less than a constituent state or something like this. So they want their territory where they can be, as they call it, the masters of their own country in that sense. And the only way to realize that is through federation. So this hegemonic realism is also telling them that even if you want a state, you have to have a partnership with Greek Cypriots in a federal solution. So
wonderful. And how can this study of North Cyprus illuminate or what can it teach us about the fact of statehood as a global phenomenon? In other words, do you hold your findings to be applicable in other cases the world over?
Well, yes. I mean, we think that they are applicable. We've done some preliminary research in Abkhazia and Transnistria, and we see a lot of comparisons there. We would say, I think that one difference between the Cyprus case and certain other cases like Abkhazia, let's say, or Transnistria, even, is that it is a space that was created ex nihilo, right? It didn't exist before. It didn't. There isn't this long history of Turkish Cypriots living in this particular space, right? They had to create it, and there had to be ethnic cleansing and so on in order for it to become the way it is now. So that's different from some place like Abkhazia, but
there was an ethnic cleansing. There
was ethnic cleansing, but there was
a claim had a territory. Yeah, imagined territory.
Yeah, exactly. But So that is different. But I mean, but looking overall at this idea of the various kinds of aporias that Turkish Cypriots experience, like their aporia of perceptibility, the fact that they're invisibilized as actors, and so on. I mean, this is very much applicable in, I would say, all of these other cases where, for example, in aphasia or Transnistria and so on, there's perception that, well, especially in aphasia, Russia is really the actor, and the Abkhaz don't have any role, right? But you go to aphasia and you see that they definitely have agency, right? I mean, there is certainly, they have certainly played a role in creating their own history. But of course, it's a small community. And this is also something that these unrecognized states have in common, that they tend to be very small, meaning that they're, on the one hand, very tightly knit, and on the other hand, politically, economically, and militarily weak. You know, so they're often dependent on some other
patron state.
A patron state.
But they also have very enclavist attitudes in that sense. I mean, they always have to have a fear, build a wall against a fear so that they keep their members inside, like Douglas's...
Mary Douglas's.
Yeah, Greek group theory suggests...
And this is not conducive to building a pluralist society, or is it?
Well, I'm not sure that that ultimately pluralism is the problem. I mean, I'm trying to think about Abkhazia as well. Well, it's, of course, there are specific elements that may create issues in terms of pluralism. And others that don't. I mean, to be more specific, if you're thinking about Cyprus, you know, or thinking about Abkhazia, this is really quite similar. I mean, here in Cyprus, it's, you know, the issues have to do with Greek Cypriots, but also with people from Turkey, right? But anyone else can come. there's not really any kind of, objection to most others. Well,
increasingly, with a lot of students.
Okay. Well, there are various kinds of ethnocentric attitudes that are actually quite similar to semi-xenophobic attitudes in the rest of Europe regarding immigrants. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I think the real issue though with the enclave that Matteo was talking about has to do with the ways that it can actually kind of distort your perception of reality or perception of the outside world. In other words, it may be difficult to, for example, you don't necessarily have any kind of drive to participate in various kinds of international organizations. Standards are limited to, what's available within the group. In other words, you're not aiming for like international standards. You're limiting yourself to, let's say, the standards of your own group and so on. So there's... It's very insulating in that sense. It's both protects you and also could potentially harm you in the sense that you may not be prepared to go out into the world in a way.
Goldfish in the pond.
Yeah.
Splendid. Finally, where has Sovereignty Suspended led you as researchers? What are you currently working on?
Go ahead. I mean, shall I or you?
Doesn't matter. Either one. Go ahead.
We are still working together, though. I mean, and we are still married. Even though we had some ups and downs with the book disagreement. I'm now increasingly more working on the return refugees and also incomplete returns, I call it, like Maronites. These are the third minority living in the third community living in Cyprus. They've been living in Cyprus for 1,000 years, but they are overlooked and everything. And they were from the north. They had four villages. One of them is still inhabitable. The other three are military zones. And there is a huge sort of work on opening these villages back to them. And so, and they want it as well. They say they don't mind living under any administration because increasingly they're disappearing in the Republic of Cyprus control areas because they are Christian and they are Catholic and they are Orthodox, but they keep marrying each other and so they're disappearing. So if they come and live in the non-Christian area, they believe that they can sustain their identity. So you have these other ironies in that sense. So they want to come back to their villages and they, I'm observing and stock-taking all these efforts and also the opening of Varosha, which is a ghost city in Cyprus, got stuck in the not in the buffer zone, but just beside the buffer zone. It's a military area. 30,000 people were displaced from there. It was the most commercial area of Cyprus. So there's a decision to open Varosha back to its owners. That means 30,000 Greek Cypriots will come back and live under Turkish control. So so it's a new experience, a new experiment in a way, not experience, but new experiment regarding the Cyprus issue. So I'm observing this and trying to sort of make a sense out of it.
Yeah. And I'm also involved with Mete in the Varosha project in a way. I have my own interest in it, having to do more with the ways in which the people are negotiating how Varosha will be used and how it will be reconstructed. But I have several different projects that I'm sort of at the moment trying to kind of decide among. I actually in the process of finishing a book manuscript that we mentioned a couple of times, that's keeping me from moving on to anything else at the moment. And that's a book that is actually about unrecognized states, but it's about unrecognized states in the context of globalization. So how does globalization affect these entities that are not supposed to be globally connected? And it affects them a lot, actually. So I'm looking at what changes within that context in terms of the ways that people perceive their state, the ways they perceive their so-called sovereignty, and so on. So in a way, it's a continuation of our joint book. And in fact, it came out of that. We, as we were writing this book, ended up with sort of three books because at one point we reached a certain stage in this writing and Mete got busy and I sort of took off and wrote 200 pages on my own. And that ended up being this other manuscript. So I'm working on revising that at the moment and then I'll be able to move on to other things.
I cannot wait to see what comes next out of this creative, productive cooperation of yours.
Thank you.
Dr. Bryant Misihata, it was an immense pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you for joining New Books in Eastern European Studies.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.